Happy New Year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. On this edition of our program, another installment in the Museum Confidential podcast series. This time out, we get to know Mark Mothersbaugh, the Devo musician, brilliant musician, but also a very active visual artist. Thanks for tuning in. Here is Museum Confidential.
As a little kid, in the heyday of MTV, Devo was certainly on my radar, but only in the sense of some eccentric novelty band with weird red hats in the video for Whip It. It wasn't until I was in my late teens, sitting in a movie theater to watch Wes Anderson's second feature, Rushmore, that my relationship to Devo began to deepen. The composer for that film was Devo's co-founder and lead singer, Mark Mothersbaugh. He'd also composed the music for Anderson's debut, Bottle Rocket, but I hadn't seen that one yet. Rushmore was my gateway drug. Within days, I purchased the CD of the soundtrack. Slowly, I began to work my way backwards, discovering all the wonderful Devo music beyond Whip It. Mothersbaugh would go on to score countless more movies and shows, including Anderson's The Royal Tenenbaums and The Life Aquatic. Last year, Philbrook began a collaboration with the popular Instagram travel and photo feed, Accidentally Wes Anderson. The AWA idea was inspired by the Wes Anderson aesthetic and invited people from all over the world to submit photographs of places and things that would fit inside Anderson's cinematic universe. The feed has grown to include millions of followers, especially in the COVID era, when many of us were only traveling via our phones. Wanderlust indeed. The work we at Philbrook did with AWA resulted in the Now On View photography exhibition, This Is an Adventure. It runs through January 2022. In the early planning stages, we had an idea. Maybe we could ask Mark Mothersbaugh to provide an in-gallery soundtrack for the show. Couldn't hurt to ask, right? So we did. And to our surprise, he agreed. Not only that, Mark supplied a curated playlist running nearly 45 minutes of never-before-heard excerpts, snippets, and clips of his soundtracks for Wes Anderson's films. And you can only hear it in the gallery. That's the deal. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
Thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us. I wanted to start by talking a little bit about how grateful we are that you are here with us. I know you've spoken pretty openly about your experience with COVID last year and how horrific that was. I don't want to spend time talking specifically about that because I know you've covered that, but I'm curious what that did to your creative process. You know, I was wondering if you'd ever seen something that kind of stopped you in your tracks because you're creating stuff so often and so prolifically. Did you have this huge gap where you weren't able to do anything? Were you still thinking about creative work even when you were kind of recovering from that? What was the impact of that on your creative work?
Well, when I went into ICU, I was working on two films and a PlayStation game all at the same time. They were both orchestral animation films. So it's a lot of music, you know, like you end up with like 85 minutes of music in a 90 minute movie and it's 100 piece orchestra. So I was writing all that. And then I was just feeling like really kind of out of it. And then ended up, next thing I knew, I was in ICU and then I was down for 20 days. So during those 20 days, there were things going on in my head, but it was not, you know, that was the longest I'd ever been out of commission ever. And I came out and I went in, I felt like I was about 50 when I first went into ICU, and I came out feeling like I was in my 90s. It was really interesting to have that kind of an experience. actually post hospital, and I had to get up right away and start finishing these scores, and I did. So I just finished them.
We are based here in Oklahoma, and you know, one thing I was so surprised by was seeing that you were scoring the Tiger King shows on Netflix.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And obviously that's something that has for ill or good or whatever, slightly define some of the rural areas of our state here. How do you get involved with a project like that? I mean, it seems a little bit off of the beaten path, but I know Randall Poster and some other people are involved with that as well. But how do you kind of get pulled into something that seems so out of left field?
I've scored a lot of documentaries. And documentaries to me, they're like, you know, when you work in film and TV, most of the time, let's be honest, you're practicing a craft. It's not really an art. You know, it's like you want it to be an art, but, you know, it's like most of the time they don't really want art. They want you to just support their images and their story and make it pay off at the end. But like with documentaries, and I've done quite a few, I've worked with that director on something else. I've worked with a number of the big documentary directors on things, and it's an excuse to write like music that you really love, because it's a bed, and the things it has to do is just basically you're just kind of like keeping, you know, documentaries can get really dry if you pull the music out, but if you put music in, it keeps them bubbling and moving along and pushing forward. So I take documentaries on all the time. I love to do those.
You know, your music has been in my life for my whole life. It seems like I can't remember when I wasn't aware of you, whether through your film work or certainly through Devo, but I didn't really become aware of your visual art until a few years ago. I had the great opportunity to interview Adam Lerner when he was still at the MCA Denver, and had just a year or two before that done this major show with you, Myopia, yes. I believe was the title. And through that work and looking back at that exhibition, I really kind of got to know your visual work and some of that as well. And it was so fun, you know, for lack of a better word, to kind of dive into that and see that side of your brain and kind of go into that world. Are we going to see any more exhibitions like that coming down the pike? Have you had anything in that in
sure.
the world?
You know, I was a visual artist. Early on, I did both, and they never seemed like they took different paths. It's just that once I got into Hollywood and it became something else, it became a business and it turned into a lot of things, music. It's like I kept my art to myself. I always had that for myself. And so I was really content not to do shows, and I did art every single day. And people just, you know, they just looked at me and said, oh, that's the autistic guy that started Devo or something like that. That's, you know, he's working on Pee Wee's Playhouse or something. But they just kind of left me alone. And I've been doing, you know, I do art every day. And I have my studio set up. So whatever project I'm working on musically, which is music pays the bills, you know, the craft of music. And then I still do artistic music for myself. And I still do visual arts for myself all the time. And I like doing shows. It's just that keeping it to myself is like also kind of satisfying. Although I do plan on more shows, you know, I would like to do more shows. You guys need a show in Oklahoma?
Definitely. Yeah, but I'm curious, you know, when you have such a strong visual sense, when you have such a particular take on what you do and you're working with a curator, for example, at a show or a gallery or a museum, is it hard to give over some of the control, you know, because curators need to kind of have a certain level of control over what they're doing. And there's that interesting relationship between the artist and the curator. Do you see that as more of a collaboration, or are you able to kind of say, hey, here's the work, you do what you want with it? Is that something that's difficult to manage?
I see. I love what curators do. I think curators, you know, that's an interesting job to pick things. And it's informative to me when I see what things, Adam said things to me that at the time I didn't agree with him, and afterwards I totally understand what he was saying. And I don't know, we got along from the beginning pretty much, though. It's like we were, whatever the reason is, we were simpatico, and I enjoy his brain. And to me, I encourage people to curate my stuff, to be honest with you. It's like, even when I did about 125 gallery shows during tours with Devo, I'm so touring was like Groundhog Day to me after a while, you know, when you're doing the same songs for 40 years, it's like, so somewhere back there, I started doing gallery shows so I could go to sound check, then I could go to a gallery opening, and then I could go to the other side of town and do a show, and then, you know, maybe come back. And I tailored the stuff I was doing for those shows specifically for, you know, what I thought would interest like pop-up gallery kind of attendance, you know, and the people that were there, which was like younger than me. And it wasn't like the rich people in town. It wasn't the doctors and the lawyers that were going to these galleries. It was kids that were skaters or whatever, you know, that were just hanging out. They were graffiti artists a lot of times. And I picked galleries that were kind of ground level because there was something satisfying about that to me, you know. And I even priced things. I made them so that they could be somewhat precious, you know, but it would still be a print. So it might be like an edition of 3 or 5 or 10 at the most. And that way I could price them so that some kid could come in there who had never bought a piece of art and he could go, you know what? I was going to get a keg for a party, but instead I'm going to buy my first piece of art. And so I got a lot of emails from kids that would send me pictures of their living room or their bedroom where the picture was hanging. And I really liked that.
I'm curious, you know, you mentioned kids there. What was your relationship like to museums as a young person? It was the Akron Art Museum, that was important.
When I was a kid, yeah. I thought they were incredible when I got to go to them, but I had this misconception of what a museum was. And it lasted with me up until I met Adam. You know, it's like I avoided galleries like Ace Gallery and bigger galleries with, I don't know if you know who had Ace Gallery, has Ace Gallery. I could say his name, but he was a friend of mine 20 years ago. And I knew that he cheated the artists. And, you know, I had friends that were artists that said, he sold everything in the show, but he didn't pay me a penny. You know, I had stories like that. And I just thought, you know, I don't like the art world. And so that's why before I met Adam, I was drawn to these small pop-up galleries. And then when I met Adam, he seemed like a really good guy. And I thought, yeah, let's do a retrospective. Because he walked through my stuff and he saw it. And he said, what are you doing with this warehouse full of stuff? And I go, I just make things, you know. And so he organized it. And I can't give him enough credit for putting the show together because, you know, I have certain areas of organization that I don't have in my head. So to put that show together, I couldn't have done it on my own.
So your idea of museums as a young person was kind of this, you were a little suspect of it, of the kind of the, it was kind of a racket. You thought it's kind of like a racket in a sense.
And elitist. I thought of them as elitist and, you know, appealing to the people that spend all the money, you know, that pay for them. You know, and have, you know, there's always strings attached, you know, when people give you money. It's like, I think the job of a museum director is one of the most thankless, difficult jobs because, you know, as soon as you hit the ground, you got to hit the ground running when you come in and you got to like go out and you got to get, you know, you got to inspire your community. You got to get them to want to donate to your museum and to see the interest. Anyhow, what happened to me is I got in to Denver and started putting the show together. And I saw the other side of museums. And to me, I traveled around to, I don't know, like 8 different museums. And, you know, without exception, the staff that work at museums and the people that are attracted to working at museums seem to love art and seem to be, they were really helpful in putting the shows together and gave me a whole nother viewpoint of what a museum was. And getting to be backstage, you know, in these museums for these shows, it made me fall in love with museums. I love museums.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Plexiglass. We want to leave objects and sculpture uncovered at the museum. We really do. But the thing is, we just can't trust you. Or your kids, for that matter. No, we don't really think you're going to steal anything. That's not you. But let's be honest here. Without that plexiglass, there would be all kinds of touching and reaching and contacting and inappropriate behavior. And guess what? We get it. The temptation is too strong. We would probably do the same thing. But thankfully for everyone, we have plexiglass. Ask for it by name.
You know, I was just kind of like, no, museums are like signing with a record company. I didn't need another Warner Brothers. Oh, did I say their name? In my life. Or worse, Virgin Records, Richard Branson.
So if you carried that skepticism kind of into adulthood, when you started touring and, you know, you're going all over the world and had opportunities to go to some of the great cities and across the world, were you not going to the museums in Paris and London and, you know, wherever else you were going? Did you kind of miss that opportunity and then hit it later on down the road?
I still went to museums and went to see things, but, you know, it's like it didn't make me feel like I wanted to be part of that world. Personally, I felt like I had more freedom and it was satisfying to me to be able to just do art every day. I was lucky enough, like I have a round building here right now. I've had it for like 30 years. And in the middle, I have a room where I write music and it's easy for me to write something there for a film. And then my engineer comes in and mixes it into the movie while I go over to the room we're in now or one of a few other rooms that I either paint in or work on computers or whatever. And then I have like a half hour while he's mixing the music. And then when he's done, I can go back and write some more music. And then I come back here and it's like, it's been an agreeable mode of operation for me. It's been an agreeable way to do things through the years. And I've started filling books with art, with images I do. Cause I was into mail art back in the 60s and 70s.
So we're looking at like a kind of a photo album with images.
The book for stamp collecting nerds. And this one, they made this exact book that I still can buy now back in the early 70s. And it got to a point where I was doing because of my eyesight, I'm not myopic anymore because I had cataract surgery. So my eyes have been through crazy things in the last couple of years. And I'm down to being a cyclops now, actually.
Yeah, for our listeners, we're speaking and you're wearing a cool eye patch. It's kind of pirate vibe. I like it. You know, it's kind of gives you kind of a Bond villain-esque kind of situation.
Yeah. But I draw on cards and I paint on them every day and write things on it. And then every time I get another 100, I fill a book up.
Would you say that that's kind of a, you know, there's kind of these daily rituals people have, but there's also that kind of fine line between your ritual and a compulsion. Do you feel like if you miss a day, are there days when you feel like I have to do my card today?
Yeah, I'll be honest about it. I'm very obsessive about it. And when I was in the hospital for 20 days, I had a lot of delusions, but I had a lot of interesting illuminations. But I had one thing that really bugged me. I wanted to get the heck out of there so I could start drawing again because I didn't have any of my materials with me. And if you have a tube going down your throat, it's like kind of like sticks you to the bed. You can't really move around too much.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
So it's like, the whole experience ended up making me like accelerate and think about how to keep these still going, you know, like, and I don't know, I'm in a really happy place as far as that's concerned. I don't know, 615 or 620 of those books that each have 100 cards and they date back to 1972.
And so do you view that as a kind of a visual diary of sorts? Is that your...
They have... some of the early ones have album covers from Devo. They later became album covers or became merchandise or, you know, like early sketches when we were interested in things like ballet mécanique. You know, we started doing our own geometric outfits and, you know, helmets and things. It's like early sketches for that stuff. And a lot of lyrics are on these cards. So,
you know, I just watched this Beatles documentary, Get Back, that Peter Jackson
did. Did you see the whole thing?
Yeah, I watched the whole thing. And what was fascinating about it was how illuminating it was about the non-glamorous side of the creative process and how much kind of just work a day, sit in a room until you come up with a thing. That became, it became almost hypnotic to me, just watching them, the repetition of certain things. Did you see something? I don't know if you've seen it, but is that something?
Yeah, I only saw the first one. So
did you relate to that? You know, because I think everybody thinks of the rock and roll recording process as this kind of, you know, touched by a muse thing, but they're in there just kind of banging away at it.
Well, I was so impressed that they could hold it together to write music while people are filming them and in the room. There's something about that. I was like, that's really great. They have such a grasp. And I mean, during the first one, John is like in some strange thing. And, you know, Yoko is kind of more of an irritant than a help, right? You know, for people. But I haven't seen the whole thing, so I don't know where it goes. But like John and Paul got together, what, like 15 or something? 14?
Yeah, I think they said 14.
Really young.
Yeah.
And you see him sitting there and he's writing a song. He's playing with a song, but he doesn't have it yet. And he's doing Hey Jude. I really enjoyed seeing other people's creative process. I love seeing that. And I think it's harder. I think they had a harder, I mean, now I have computers to prop me up, you know, so that when I write something, I don't have to try and remember what I played an hour and a half ago. It's there. You can like start layering things in and you can mutate them as you go. And I just felt for them when I saw the pain they have, because the reality of it is, it's creativity, when it involves collaboration, is a tricky thing, you know? It's like every band eventually turns into Spinal Tap, whether you want it to or not.
This thing that struck me the most was just how applicable it probably is to every band, you know, and that's what I thought was pretty ingenious about it. Like, you could apply the same thing to kids in a garage banging around trying to come up with a good idea. And I thought that was the universal thing about it that made me interested. I want to jump, before we run out of time here, I want to touch on one of the reasons we're talking today, which is you were kind enough to provide us about 45 minutes of unheard snippets, clips, sequences from the Wes Anderson films that you've provided scores for our exhibition, which is called This Is an Adventure. And it is a photo show inspired by the aesthetics of Wes Anderson. So for people listening, if you go there, the only place you can hear this music is in the gallery. So when you walk in there, we have this, you know, a speaker there playing. It looks like it's playing through an old tiny radio, but it's all kind of rigged up behind the scenes. But this music's kind of playing in the gallery. And it's pretty cool because we have people coming in just to hear the music, which is pretty fun. You know, it's not the average museum experience because, you know, they're so interested and they're so, you know, people are so allegiant to his films and then that world that, you know, they just want to come in. So it's funny just to walk in the gallery and you can tell that they looked at the art, but sometimes they just sit down on the bench and they're just listening to the music. First of all, thank you for doing that. And is that stuff that's just sitting around all the time? Does every film or project have a lot of unused music?
I have a very large warehouse filled with artwork, but filled with Devo stuff, you know, and filled with personal stuff. Like, yeah, every film, like the more I like a film, the more music I'll write for it. Like, I think all of Wes's movies, I'd score them and then it'd be like when you're reading a good book and you get to the last page and you don't want it to be over. And I'd start over and I go, what's a whole nother way to do it? So he always had a choice of two totally different scores for each of his movies, because I just love to write music to his films. And I do that with a lot of the films I work on. I overwrite. So I have this abundance. I have about another, like 100 hours of music that I just wrote for my own satisfaction. And a lot of this stuff was either work in progress for his films, or it was written during that time period, maybe, or in some way related to his films.
You know, one of the best things about it is people don't know what they're hearing. Like, you know, it's not identified what's from which film or anything like that. But then as you listen to it, if you know the films, you can kind of, it's kind of a game in a sense, you can kind of start to think like, yeah, that sounds like that's from that milieu. That might be a Life Aquatic, or that might be a Royal Tenenbaum or something like that. A lot of people ask us, you know, why you don't score his films anymore, of course. And I think people thought originally this was going to be like a Spielberg, John Williams kind of situation here. But of course, you've gone on to do a million other things. Do you think that you guys will work together again? Do you see those paths diverging? Or, you know, where does that stand now?
You know, if I was a director, I can't say I would hire the same composer every time. You know, I can't say I would do that. But I did his first four movies, and then I worked on the fifth one, too. I worked on a fifth one with him. You know, maybe he has another story, but the way I remember it is he asked me to score Mr. Fox, and he wanted me to come to France. And I said, you know what? The exact time you need me there, I'm in China adopting a baby. And so I couldn't go over, and it gave another music agent a chance to get their client in there. And he's not a bad composer, you know. I like some of his stuff, you know. I hope someday, you know, Wes calls me again and says, hey, let's do another film. But, you know, I had a really good experience. And I got to work with him on his early films, and I watched him develop as an artist and a filmmaker. It was interesting. I remember on Bottle Rocket, it was just the beginning, and he was even like scared to listen to certain instruments. He was afraid of an orchestra, and I watched him change over time and develop, and I watched his palette expand.
One of my favorite things was when I first saw, I was a huge fan of those film, early films especially, and I heard that there were a couple of cues, or at least one cue, that was used in multiple films, and I thought that was kind of a fun reuse. There's a piece called Snowflake Music, I believe, that was used in both Bottle Rocket and in Rushmore, and I just thought that was kind of a fun thing. Well, I think, you know, but just to put a point on that, it's so fun to see how people come in different camps. We have people who come in because we've had this show up for a while, and they're like, the Mark Mothersbaugh music is the music of this film. It's like, yeah, I will have the early films, that's my music, because people have such an emotional connection when they hear that opening chords of Rushmore come onto the screen, even as the Touchstone logo is happening, that kind of sound. People, it does something to people. So just to kind of wrap it up, I'll say, you know, thank you for doing this work. It does make a difference. It impacts people. And I can see it every day, people coming in to hear this music, and they're so excited, and it makes people happy. And I don't know what else could we want more than that. So
yeah, he's a great artist to celebrate, and I was glad to be part of it.
So it turns out that I was actually exposed to Mark Mothersbaugh's film and TV scoring well before Wes Anderson hit the scene, many years before actually, and weekly. Pee-wee's Playhouse ran Saturday mornings on CBS from 1986 to 1990, and Mothersbaugh wrote the theme song. I knew it by heart, still do in fact. I could sing it, but instead... Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.